KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. I'm Michael Krasny. It is America's longest war, and there's no end in sight. In his new book, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Steve Cole sheds new light on why the United States is still in Afghanistan 17 years later, and why even the generals say a military solution won't work.
And yet we keep prioritizing military action. To complement that or to ultimately replace it, we need diplomacy. We need a State Department that is out active negotiating for whatever is possible in a difficult region.
Steve Cole joins us in the studio to talk about his new book, Directorate S, the CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan. That's coming up next, after this. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Pulitzer Prize-winning author Steve Cole's new book is called Directorate S, and it illustrates the political actors and motivations of America's post-9/11 military efforts in Afghanistan and Pakistan. He describes muddled combat strategies, diplomatic failures, and military miscalculations in what has become the United States' longest-running war. And Steve Cole is dean of the Columbia Journalism School. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker. His previous books include Ghost Wars and the Bin Ladens, and he joins us in this Forum Hour. And welcome back to Forum. Good to have you.
Thanks, Michael. Good to be back.
Well, where do we begin? I mean, this is a book of incredible array of blunders and missteps and ruinous decisions, but let's begin by just letting listeners know what we're talking about here. The Inner Services Intelligence, the ISI of Pakistan, and then we can talk about the director that's within the ISI. Let's set this stage for us, if you could.
So ISI is the main Pakistani intelligence service, and during the 1980s, when the CIA worked with ISI to defeat the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan, it infused the service with billions of dollars in resources, both U.S. money and Saudi money. And so ISI grew to become a kind of state within the Pakistani state, in charge particularly of its
deep state, would
strategy.
We call it?
Yeah, they do call it the deep state. And its main focus has always been India, because that's Pakistan's existential rival. And this covert action arm within ISI that the Americans refer to as Directorate S, was the unit that supported the Taliban and other militants operating outside of Pakistan in Afghanistan or Kashmir.
But we go back when we talk about Pakistan and Kashmir and the, shall we say, ongoing dispute over Kashmir between India and Pakistan and all of that, to a sense of the Soviet occupation. I mean, to a great extent, a lot of this really begins there, doesn't it?
Yes. I mean, when you think about Afghanistan being at war for so long, we have to remind ourselves that Afghanistan was at peace with itself and with its neighbors for most of the 20th century. And it fell apart not because of its own internal conflicts, but because it was invaded by the Soviet Union. And that touched off the Mujahideen rebellion that the CIA and ISI assisted. And then after the Soviets left, the country collapsed into civil war and the Taliban took over, Al-Qaeda arrived, and that's where 9/11 came from. And so this book starts there on 9/11 with, you know, an Afghanistan that has been at war for 20 years and taken over by radicals with Pakistan's support.
And with the duplicitous Pakistan, I mean, that has been almost an ongoing motif, Musharraf supporting the Taliban, as you say, Director S supporting the Taliban, I mean, giving aid and in a sense, really being a major ally, whereas the United States thought, well, they're involved in this counterterrorism effort. We're giving them all this money. I just wondered, you know, when I get back to the history and all that you've managed to bring to light here, but when President Trump calls up these kind of strong sentiments and says, you know, we've been supporting Pakistan for too long, all of our money's been wasted, there's something to be said for that argument.
There is. You know, it's a complicated story, and we're complicit in it, too. I mean, we did provide Pakistan an enormous amount of aid. And during some of that time, especially the first couple of years after 9/11, the Pakistani security services arrested significant al-Qaeda leaders, authors of the 9/11 attacks. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was arrested in a Pakistani CIA operation inside Pakistan. So there was a basis for trusting them, but it gradually eroded. And by 2006, I think the Pakistani high command had made a decision to revive the Taliban because it concluded that the United States was more interested in partnership with India than it was in partnership with Pakistan. And it also concluded that the United States had gotten itself so bogged down in Iraq that it was basically out of Afghanistan and that the Pakistanis needed to start to prepare for a world after American involvement.
Both really justifiable conclusions. I mean, especially the nuclear deal with India, and Pakistan was not made a deal.
Right. It was a big agreement with India. We essentially forgave India for violating the nuclear nonproliferation regime. And then we said to Pakistan, sorry, you're not going to get that deal because your record is too unreliable. And Pakistanis heard that loud and clear. Look, their country had also been destabilized by the 2001 war. We went in, we smashed the Taliban government, we killed a lot of al-Qaeda, we disrupted al-Qaeda. But the survivors went across the border into Pakistan, where they joined with local radical groups and ended up touching off, you know, the worst domestic terrorism that Pakistan has ever known. And the Pakistanis looked at that, tens of thousands of their own dying in these truck bombings and mass casualty attacks. And, you know, there was a strain of their analysis that said, you know, this is really the Americans' fault. We told them that they were going to destabilize our country. They have done so. And so now they come pressuring us for help. But we got to take care of our own business here.
We know now pretty much, getting back to ISI, that they were behind the Mumbai attack back in 2008. What we don't know but maybe can presume is that they may have been behind keeping bin Laden safe in Abbottabad.
Yes. Yes to both. They were definitely the authors of the Mumbai attack. The evidence trail leads to particular ISI officers, and I think so does the communications trail. It's pretty well established. I think Abbottabad is a bit more of a mystery. Been some credible journalists that have quoted anonymous sources saying that the Pakistanis were involved in hiding him there. I myself could not find positive on the record evidence in documents or in interviews to support that, but I'm entirely prepared to believe it. It would be consistent with Pakistan's interests and conduct. But there is an interesting kind of ambiguity about what they did and didn't do for bin Laden when he fled into Pakistan to hide. It's contained in all these hundreds and hundreds of letters bin Laden wrote that have been declassified and translated. And I went through them all looking for this, and there's a couple of interesting strands. He wants his kids to come live with him in this compound, but he is writing to them saying, watch out for the Pakistani police. You know, they're, don't rely on Pakistan during your travels. And, you know, at the same time, there's another bit of testimony from one of his wives that when they moved houses at one point earlier, there was a Pakistani policeman in the vehicle with them. So, you know, the Pakistanis, if they did help him, would have been interested in not getting caught. So they no doubt would have said to him, don't call us. We'll call you. Hunker down. Try not to call attention to yourself.
We're talking to Steve Call, and Steve Call has a new book out called Directorate S, the CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan. He's staff writer for The New Yorker and dean of the Columbia Journalism School. There is a sense in your book that comes across that there were some dreadful American mistakes during the Bush administration and the Obama administration, but also there were miscalculations and grievous mistakes made by the Afghan government, mostly under Karzai, and also by the Pakistanis. And the sense that you seem to come away with here is that the jihadist movement would not have been really, I'm talking about al-Qaeda, Taliban, even ISIS, that it would not have had the strength that it has or the power that it has or the momentum, for that matter, had it not been for all these terrible mistakes.
Well, we certainly failed to repress it in the strategies that we pursued. And, of course, the Pakistanis deliberately cultivated this movement at times to pursue their interests against India. I think counterfactual history is kind of a fool's game, but I have to think about it after working on this project for so long, and I'm often asked, you know, were there opportunities to do better? Where might we have made a decisive difference? And I think the answer to me is pretty clear. It was right after the fall of the Taliban government in December 2001, when the international community supported the restoration of Afghan sovereignty. The Bonn Agreement created a new constitution. Afghans themselves returned home. They staged a successful presidential election, a successful parliamentary election. The country was more or less at peace. And what did we do? We went off and invaded Iraq. We declined to invest in serious reconstruction and security. We did not build up Afghan security forces so they could defend themselves.
And we're opposed to nation building under Bush, at least.
It was an ideological decision, as well as, I think, influenced by the immediate commitment to the war in Iraq. There's a scene in the book where these, you know, U.S. generals come out in the summer of 2002 to set up this modest security force in Afghanistan. And their mission is mostly terrorist hunting, but also supporting Afghanistan as it gets reorganized. And they go off, they get called off to a meeting in Europe, and they come back and they say to their colleagues, you know, we're going to war in Iraq. This is like June 2002. This is decided. And so let's not build anything permanent here because we're not going to be here for very long. And that reality, I think, you know, influenced the course of events in Afghanistan right through 2004, 2005, which is when the war started again and the Taliban came back.
I've also been reading simultaneously with reading your book, both tomes, Max Boot's new book about the Vietnam War. And the argument there is if they had moved forward toward Hearts and Minds, it would have had possibly another road taken or a different outcome, even though, like you say, sometimes it's a fool's game to think about alternate histories and where they might go. But clearly there were some decidedly and dramatically terrible mistakes made, especially after 9/11. But getting back even before, I mean, Tora Bora, take us there. I mean, some foolishness and foolish mistakes made there, terrible errors.
Yeah, it was a decisive moment in the war against al-Qaeda and the Taliban that the Bush administration launched in response to the 9/11 attacks, when bin Laden was up on this mountainside where he had history. He had built caves up there, and the Americans sent a spotting force, Delta Force, up there on the side of the mountain. They could see that he was there. They could overhear his communications. But then this big debate ensued in Washington about whether to lift U.S. troops up to the mountain to block bin Laden from going into Pakistan. And the book tries to unpack best of what we know about why that decision was made not to block the back door. And, you know, part of it was fear based on the Soviet experience in Afghanistan, that if we put American troops directly into these villages on these mountainsides, that we'd stimulate some kind of spontaneous local reaction of a Black Hawk Down type. I think that was a mistaken fear, but you can imagine, based on the Soviet experience, why that advice was given. Anyway, it was a missed opportunity because bin Laden survived, and because he escaped and then took refuge in Pakistan and began to redirect al-Qaeda from there, we ended up trapped in a much longer conflict with al-Qaeda than we might have otherwise been in.
What about the role of the Saudis in all this, particularly having made, you know, a sanctuary for al-Qaeda or helped to make that sanctuary in Afghanistan, and the Saudis giving an extraordinary amount of money to the Afghan fight against, which became the fight against America, Taliban fight?
Yeah, after 2001, of course, the United States and Saudi Arabia became estranged because of the role that Saudis had played in the 9/11 attacks. Those were Saudis on those planes, by and large. The greatest number of the hijackers were from Saudi Arabia. And it exposed a kind of hypocrisy in the relationship that the two elites had tried to sort of cover up, but which would now alienated both publics, the American public and the Saudi public. For its part, you know, the kingdom after 2001 became the subject of its own attacks by al-Qaeda against the royal family, and so it cracked down in Saudi Arabia. And as to the Afghan war, you know, they just didn't want to get too caught up in the American adventure there. They tried to stay out. They advised the Americans against aggressive military action. They provided support to Pakistan because that is an ally that's very important to Saudi Arabia, which is a doesn't have a strong army compared to Pakistan's. It's always relied on Pakistan as kind of part of Saudi Arabia's own defense strategy.
You mentioned in your book, though, that this whole question of just what kind of faith and jihadi ideology Pakistani military has, because the military really is hegemonic in Pakistan. And you say that the senior officers are more pious and the junior officers are more nationalistic.
Than in generations before.
I'm sorry, let me reverse that. The junior are more pious, than generations before, and the senior are more nationalistic.
Yes, yeah. I mean, you know, there's always been this kind of cynicism among the senior Punjabi Pakistani military generals about managing the jihadis. So they'll go to the office and they'll support these radical groups and give them guns and money and give them sort of speeches of exhortation. And then they'll go home and pull out a bottle of Black Label and have a whiskey and say hello to their daughter who's back from an Ivy League university. I mean, there was a kind of sense that the secular Pakistani leadership used these groups as an instrument of their national security policy, but didn't necessarily buy into their ideology. Over the years, I think that's drifted. I think there's been more of a soft Islamicization inside Pakistan, including in the top ranks of the military. But if you go out with the Pakistan Army, you see that it's really the junior officers, the sergeants and the corporals and the enlisted men who are truly much more religious than you would have seen 20 or 30 years ago.
You also write about CIA abuse and torture in Afghanistan really having a serious adverse effect on the Afghan people.
Yeah, I tried to take the torture story that we've all become too familiar with and that other investigative reporters have done such great work on and really locate it in Afghanistan because, you know, the secret prisons, the CIA secret prisons, now notorious, were built to house al-Qaeda prisoners and were offshore out in Thailand or Morocco, different places. In Afghanistan, it was sort of like the minor leagues of torture, but it had really serious consequences for the American war. I tell the case of a CIA contractor who murdered an Afghan detainee at an obscure fire base in northeastern Afghanistan, and it was a kind of typical example. This was not a strategic interrogation program. There was no rationalization that we were going to be preventing terrorist attacks in New York or Washington by detaining and roughing up these people. It was just a kind of a brutal archipelago within Afghanistan that became part of the American face of the war. And so you'd have all these detainees subject to this kind of treatment, and then they'd be released and they'd go home to their villages and say, let me tell you about the Americans. You know, they're not much different than the Soviets were. And it was a very poorly supervised and certainly poorly conceived way to manage detention.
Our guest is Steve Call, and his new book is out, and it's called Directorate S, the CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan. You were talking before, Steve, about how the Bush administration was so invested in Iraq that it made them, to some extent, move away from Afghanistan. Almost a reverse with Obama at first. And in fact, you take us into Joe Biden's house and all this discussion going on, and they clearly wanted to not only move away from Iraq because they didn't believe it was just and so forth, despite, you know, McCain saying there should be maybe more soldiers, at least a limited number and so forth. But it's dragged on and it continues to drag on, although they seem to give a great deal of priority to Afghanistan and yet couldn't resolve things, they increased the drone war, as you point out, and so forth. What happened? There was actually some secret negotiations going on to try to make a peace treaty with the Taliban.
Mm-hmm.
Why did that go south? Why did that fail?
Well, to begin with, as you say, I mean, the Obama administration inherited this war, and it had campaigned for office. President Obama had campaigned for office, promising to fix the Afghan war, the good war. But they became entangled in that initial year with their own kind of sense of their own failure to resolve some of the contradictions in the war. Joe Biden goes out to Kabul and he meets with President of Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai. And Karzai says, you know, the problem with this war is really it's in Pakistan. And Biden says, Mr. President, Pakistan is 50 times more important to the United States than Afghanistan. Okay, blunt talk, but evidence that the Obama administration is escalating a war in Afghanistan when the interests that it identifies that matter most to the United States, al-Qaeda, the security of Pakistan's nuclear weapons, they're across the border in Pakistan. So why are we sending 100,000 men and women into harm's way in Afghanistan? And, you know, the president, I think by the end of 2009, early 2010, he'd lost faith in the Pentagon's promises of victory through counterinsurgency doctrine. And he turned to a negotiating strategy with the Taliban to see if he could find a way to end the war or at least write a map to an American exit from the war that would reduce the violence. These negotiations went on in secret for 2.5 years. It's a fascinating story. The Taliban identified a negotiator, Tayyip Aga, who was the head of their political commission. He ended up having a number of meetings with American negotiators to try to build confidence, open a political office. But then they collapsed. The negotiations failed for several reasons. One, Hamid Karzai was so estranged from the United States that he just didn't believe in these talks, and he undermined them. He kind of blew them up. And also, the problem of ISI recurred. You know, the Afghan Taliban said to the Americans, we don't want to be clients of Pakistan. We're Afghans. We don't want them to be our negotiating agent. We want to talk to you directly. And the Americans would say, okay, we'll talk to you directly, but, you know, Pakistan is where you live. Pakistan is where all the mischief comes from. We're going to have to get them in the game at some point. And ISI was, you know, maneuvering and really undermined the potential for progress.
Well, there was this notion of all these tribal areas, right, in Pakistan, and they were supposedly lands unto themselves and ruled by warlords. And in fact, what about Karzai and the warlords? I mean, to some extent, the narrative was that he was constantly fighting with them and battled by them.
Yeah, I mean, he was, after all, he had no real political base in the country when we brought him to power with CIA and special forces help.
It may have been just in Kabul alone, pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, his family did have roots in Kandahar. His father had been a member of the Senate. And so he had some, you know, sort of identity as a tribal figure. But he was a relatively weak president. He didn't have any men under arms. He depended on the international community for his legitimacy and for his security. And he found himself at odds with all these warlords around the country who had been installed in power, often by the CIA and special forces teams for the sake of regional security. But these men were often part of the reason the Taliban had come to power in the first place. They'd been corrupt. They'd been predatory in their regions, but they provided a rough kind of security. So Karzai kept saying to the Americans, you know, if you want me to run this country, you're going to have to reduce the power of these regional figures. The Americans cooperated to some extent for a while, but, you know, in the end, Karzai was always a creature of international patronage, and he was really, as some people put it, maybe a little too harshly, he was the mayor of Kabul, and in his political constituency outside of Kabul was always a work in progress.
Our guest is Steve Cole, and we're talking with him about his new book, Directorate S, The CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan. He's staff writer for The New Yorker and dean of the Columbia Journalism School, and we invite you to join this conversation. Questions or comments, please feel free to be part of the program. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. The fact is, the war still goes on, and there's still no plan, really, as to how to resolve this war in Afghanistan. You may have some thoughts. We'd like to hear them. Any questions or comments are welcome. Again, toll-free, join us now at 866-733-6786. You can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum, or go to our Facebook page, but please feel free to be part of the program. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour here in studio with me is Steve Cole, and he's the author of a new book called Directorate S, The CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan. He's also staff writer for The New Yorker and dean of the Columbia Journalism School. And we're going to go right to your calls and emails here. I just have to ask, though, Steve, I mean, I said before when we went to the break that there's still no plan, that the military is continuing to be engaged in Afghanistan. The war goes on. There's a kind of candid admission that it can't be won that way, but what to do? And to some extent, one thinks of diplomacy, but this is an administration, by the way, we should mention Pakistan is moving ever closer to China probably, but this is an administration that seems to be, when it comes to diplomacy, I mean, there are places in the State Department that are still vacant. The importance of resolving this war does not seem to be high, at least on the triage list for this administration.
Yeah, I think that comes from the top. The president just, you know, has said that he wants the military to be in the lead. He has not turned to the State Department to at the highest levels to try to craft some alternative to this endless military action. And then the man he's appointed as Secretary of State has overseen the diminishment of the State Department, the departure of many experienced Foreign Service officers. You know, there are people in the mid-levels of the State Department that are still traveling around the region trying to talk about ways to move forward off the battlefield, but it's not resourced at the highest levels of government.
I'll read a couple of comments here, and then we'll go to your calls. Ben says, with rising tensions with Iran, strategically speaking, can the U.S. afford to lose its foothold in Afghanistan, even if that country is in a perpetual state of war? And then Francis says, for many years, Lindsey Graham has been saying the U.S. should be in Afghanistan for perpetuity. I've always assumed that he was representing the military-industrial complex. His opinion seemed to be supported by both parties' votes. But does the public support a perpetual war in Afghanistan? I think the answer to that is probably no. But there is that argument kind of implicit in this, isn't it? Stay there, because we have to stay there. Otherwise, it's going to become another sanctuary for al-Qaeda or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit like Vietnam in that neither party is willing to accept responsibility for a complete break with the war because of the fear that the consequences would threaten American security and that they would be blamed for that. And so there is, compared to Vietnam, there does seem to be more political support in Congress for this war, certainly at this level of investment, 10 to 15,000 troops, certainly many, many billions of dollars. But I think it may be up to the public to try to force, if not this administration, the next one, to come up with a vision of an end state that doesn't require the United States to be at war forever in Afghanistan.
Well, one of our listeners wants to know, are there some practical exit strategies?
Well, diplomacy is usually the way out in these wars. You know, they can go on for a long time, especially when the guerrilla group has a geographical sanctuary, as the Taliban do in Pakistan, especially when they can self-finance, as the Taliban can do with the opium trade. But the way these wars end, as in Lebanon, as in Colombia, as in Northern Ireland, is through negotiations. And those negotiations usually take a while to set up. They involve making contact, trying to build confidence, trying to establish ground on which a negotiation could occur. There's a question of whether a group like the Taliban would ever accept politics as an alternative to war. And they are an extremist organization with some hardliners. But, you know, during the secret talks that the Obama administration held with them, the Taliban said, you know, things like, we've learned our lessons. We don't want to be a pariah in the international system. We're not against women's education. We're not fighting to segregate women. You know, maybe this was all propaganda, but the proposition was never tested because the talks collapsed early. And the last thing I think about sometimes, you know, the Lebanon civil war, which lasted more than a decade and involved some pretty radical players like Hezbollah, you know, they did ultimately come to a settlement that at least resolved Lebanon's internal violence, didn't solve the problem from Israel's perspective. But, you know, politics is messy and complicated, and you can't reduce violence in a place like Afghanistan without talking.
Sometimes there's just a tipping point. You get to entropic levels where war is concerned, and suddenly things just can move forward, whereas before they didn't seem to be movable at all. But let me move to our callers and find out what's on their minds. And we begin, Dan, with you. You're on, Dan.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I'm interested in counterfactuals. That's the business of our intelligence services, of our analysts at the CIA. And my question for you, Mr. Cole, is there a consensus on Tora Bora in our intelligence agencies that we screwed up there? And also, is there consensus about whether the invasion of Iraq was a screw-up or not? Thank you.
I think there's pretty much a consensus in both the military and the intelligence services that the invasion of Iraq was a horrible strategic mistake. And on Tora Bora, I think it's more of a split verdict. The intelligence agencies will say, we did our bit. We told you he was there. We don't have the units to block the back door. But it was a whole of government failure in a lot of ways, because the military leaders at Central Command, who were primarily responsible for the war, really just didn't seem to think through the problem of escape. And there's some scenes in the book where they go to talk about the back door with Musharraf and the leader of Pakistan, and General Musharraf says, Look, if you want me to block their escape routes, I'm happy to do it because I don't want these people in my country, but you got to give me some helicopters. And the Americans said, we don't have any helicopters. Okay, well, that's something that maybe somebody should have been thinking about back in October. So I think, yes, there are certainly generals who I interviewed for this book who will identify the failure to put a blocking force up there as one of the big missed opportunities of that phase of the war.
Let me bring on more of our callers, and we'll go next to Sam. Sam, join us. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. The comment that I wanted to make was that the author said that the mistake was made in 2001 December when Taliban has been routed. There should have been a focus on nation building and things like that, and instead we went into war in Iraq. Instead, I think the problem started when the U.S. left Afghanistan alone and after the Soviets were going back. I mean, there was no nation-building effort at that time. At that time, these rival factions which were fighting the Soviets started fighting each other and created the whole problem that we are facing now at this point.
Yeah, I think, I would say both are mistakes. And the one you mentioned is the subject of the first volume in this kind of two-volume series, Ghost Wars. And I think, part of the thinking of the United States after 2001 was shaped by a recognition that it had been an error to leave Afghanistan after the defeat of the Soviet occupation. Robert Gates, for example, who was defense secretary in both the Bush and Obama administrations, had lived that experience as a CIA analyst and leader in the early 90s. And he would often say to the cabinet, we can't do that again. We've got to hang in there. And that was part of the basis for deciding to escalate the war, that, well, we can't make that mistake that we made in the 90s again. Instead, we made a different series of mistakes.
Let me thank the caller. We'll go to more calls in just a moment. Let me go to a tweet from Steve, who writes, what are Steve Cole's thoughts on why the United States funded Pakistan, knowing full well that Pakistan was funding militant activities in Afghanistan, and why all of a sudden U.S. gets to just walk away from that and let the bullets hit Pakistan alone?
Well, I think the United States went through a couple of phases in its relationship with Pakistan after 2001. In the first phase, it believed that President Musharraf was genuinely cooperative, and he arrested these al-Qaeda leaders in Pakistan, and Afghanistan didn't seem to be in too much trouble. The U.S. was distracted by Iraq, and they really didn't see ISI coming. After 2006, when they began to understand that Pakistan was, in fact, supporting the Taliban in a significant way, they were reluctant to put too much pressure on Pakistan or to withdraw aid because Pakistan was going through its own dark period of internal violence and terrorism.
This is around the time that Prime Minister Bhutto was assassinated.
Yeah, she was assassinated, and it even got worse after that. In 2009, the Pakistani Taliban kind of came out of the western area of the country and looked like they were marching on Islamabad. I mean, there was a genuine fear the Taliban were going to enter into the capital. And part of what cautioned the United States, what shaped the United States' efforts, was the fact that Pakistan had all these nuclear weapons, more than 100 of them, and dozens of terrorist groups on Pakistani soil. And the nightmare scenario, as I think it was Stephen Hadley, President Bush's national security advisor, put it even in the first deliberations after 9/11, the nightmare scenario is that we wage this war in a way that destabilizes Pakistan to the point where they lose control of their nuclear weapons. That would be the worst of all possible outcomes. Well, by 2009, 2010, that scenario did not seem out of the question. And so the U.S. was kind of deterred from putting too much pressure on Pakistan or withdrawing aid from Pakistan because it feared that it would just accelerate the collapse of the country.
Pakistan, if anything, has more nuclear weapons now. And how well, from your research, are they really guarded and monitored?
Well, the Pakistanis say we got it under control. We are always worried that they don't. We keep providing them with offers of security. But the biggest problem in the last few years is that Pakistan's nuclear strategy has shifted toward building smaller, more portable tactical weapons, they're called, lower yield weapons that are meant to scare India into the thought that Pakistan might use them on a battlefield short of like a big, apocalyptic exchange. We're doing the same thing. In fact, we just announced this as part of our new nuclear strategy review to counter Russian development of smaller weapons. But the point is, in Pakistan, if you've got a bunch of smaller bombs that are more portable, then the systems are more vulnerable to theft or to some kind of terrorist operation to seize control of them.
And let me just add that just over the weekend, there was terrorist activity not only in Afghanistan but in Kashmir just this past weekend. You get these small nuclear devices in there, and you think about Mumbai and so forth. It's pretty scary, harrowing stuff. Let me get some more callers on. Rob, thanks for waiting. Rob, you're on.
Hi, Michael. And Steve, I want you to clear something up. Now, is it the Haqqani Network, which is the Pakistan ISI-supported Taliban that goes in and wreaks havoc in Afghanistan, including killing Americans over the years? Oh, and if that's true, do they have then they have a safe haven, obviously, in Pakistan? Why don't we take out their safe havens? And is there another safe haven of the Taliban that's sort of domestically grown in Afghanistan? And is that the one that you referred to as the Pakistani Taliban that was going to march on Islamabad? And do they have a safe haven in Pakistan? And because you know the military maxim that no insurgency has ever been defeated without when there's a cross-border safe haven, like we discovered in Vietnam and stuff. So why don't we just take out these strategically, take out with air bombing these safe havens and say, you not only are you not getting our billions, you're not going to support these Taliban folks in your country, and also you might get some money back if you desist in supporting them.
Well, there's a lot of myriad number of questions there, I think. But,
yeah. Well, so, I mean, the Haqqani Network is a good place to start. So I think you described them accurately. They're an element of the Taliban, semi-independent, though they swear allegiance to the Taliban's leadership. They're located in a strategic area of the Afghan-Pakistan border. They've enjoyed support from ISI over the years, and they are particularly effective in attacking Kabul and carrying out mass casualty attacks in Kabul against often Afghan civilian targets. And, you know, the U.S. did try to bomb them into submission during the Obama administration. That's where the drone war was really directed, to try to break up these Haqqani units. But it's very difficult to defeat guerrillas in such territory from the air. And when the U.S. would try to go in occasionally on the ground, stage special forces raids, the Pakistanis would react, very harshly. And there's a scene in the book where even at the last months of the Bush administration, they're in the Situation Room, and President Bush, you know, observes, sort of like the caller did, well, it seems like all of these sanctuaries are actually inside Pakistan. Can't we go in and just blow them up? And Michael Hayden, I think, was then the CIA director. He says, you know, Mr. President, we can't go in blowing up buildings in Pakistani cities. It's just, it's not going to have the, it's going to destabilize the country and make things worse. It's also probably not territory where we could very easily operate. And, you know, the reality today is that Pakistan has restored a lot of its security compared to the dark days of 2009. Just in the last couple of years, they've gotten kind of a grip on things again. They still have a serious domestic terrorism problem, but it's much better than it was. And one of the reasons they've achieved this is that they've managed to push the violence back into Afghanistan. They've managed to kick out some of these militant groups or pay them or encourage them to go over the border into Afghanistan. And now they're in eastern Afghanistan, and they're menacing the Afghan populations there. And also, they're who we're at war with these days. So, you know, to some extent, Pakistan has restored its security at Afghanistan's expense.
And ISIS has found a foothold in Afghanistan as well.
In this very region of eastern Afghanistan. And they seem to have been, they seem to have come into Afghanistan from Pakistan and formed this rival to the Taliban. There's a lot of conspiracy theories about their origins. But, you know, the Islamic State is a bigger brand name in global terrorism these days than Al-Qaeda. And so some opportunists decided to set up shop there. They've been quite ruthless, even by Taliban standards, in eastern Afghanistan, carrying out sectarian beheadings and just horrible atrocities against local civilians. And the Taliban have been kind of at war with the Islamic State. So you have another war within the war these days.
Steve Call is our guest. And again, his new book is called Directorate S, the CIA and the Americas and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Let me bring another caller aboard here. Jack, join us. You're on the air.
Hey, I had a different question when I first called, but listening to what has been said, I just really want to bring it back to the personal level. A friend of mine that I went to high school with went to West Point, graduated with honors, trained for 6 months, went to Vietnam, and was dead in a month. And, you know, every day you see on the television all these young men with artificial limbs. When is this silliness going to stop, when officials are willing to just throw human bodies at problems?
Well, you know, we paid a high price in Afghanistan for all of these decisions and all this history. More than 2,000 American dead, 20,000 wounded, and as you say, many limbs lost. Tried to write about what that fight was like on the ground in these irrigated areas outside of Kandahar, where you couldn't walk, you know, 5 feet without triggering an IED that the Taliban had implanted, and what a hard and costly slog that war was for goals that, you know, weren't always easy for the soldiers and officers involved to describe. You know, the losses we've suffered in Afghanistan are small compared to Vietnam, but they're not small in the lives of the families that have endured them. We have reduced our troop presence now. We're 10 to 15,000 soldiers over there. There are occasional deaths through the Special Forces advisory work where they go out with Afghan forces. But mostly we're the Air Force in Afghanistan these days. And so we have reduced the exposure of American volunteers. And still, you would wish for all of this sacrifice to lead somewhere. And that's kind of where I think we have to be asking our government to do better.
Well, let me read a comment that's on point here from a listener. It says, after so much loss of human life, American, Afghan, Pakistani, and others, as well as the loss of trillions of dollars, it's time for the U.S. to totally withdraw from the region and let the countries there solve their own problems. Short of that, there will only be more bloodshed, loss of human life, and drain on the American treasury. The only thing is, I can understand the sentiments there, but, you know, when you think about American presence leaving entirely from, for example, Afghanistan was a sanctuary that harbored not only the Taliban, continues to have, but al-Qaeda, and was the launching pad for 9/11. I only bring that up because it's often brought up, but by the same token, you can say that there are other places, Somalia comes quickly to mind, that could be used in a similar way.
Yeah. No, that's true. I mean, the difference is partly that Afghanistan is next door to Pakistan, which has nuclear weapons, which has been
a
launching.
Big difference. Yeah.
And also, you know, the 9/11 attacks were staged out of Afghanistan, but the fact that those conspirators could move freely through Pakistan and travel internationally out of Pakistan was critical to the way they carried out that plot. You know, the Islamic State is in Afghanistan. Is it the most potent chapter of the Islamic State in the world? No, but it is part of a movement that just recently slaughtered people on the streets of Paris. And so I think all of the neighbors in the region, China, Iran, Russia, even Pakistan, they understand the counterterrorism mission that the Americans are pursuing against the Islamic State, against the international groups. You know, China doesn't want Afghanistan to be a cauldron of cross-border terrorists any more than we do. But we have so prioritized military action over other ways of trying to reduce the threat, for example, by calling all of these countries into a common cause of stabilizing Afghanistan, taking a little more of an alliance-based approach, that we feel trapped in a way that I think is unnecessary. There are alternatives short of full and immediate withdrawal that could create an exit for our troops, as well as a possibility of a more sustainable counterterrorism mission in the region.
Let me bring another caller aboard here, and I think it's Moline, a Pakistani. Hi, Moline, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm a Pakistani-American, and I will definitely buy this book. The question I have for your guest is that I want to know how much time he has spent in that part of the world. How many ISI agents, Afghan nationals, Taliban, or Mujahideen has he met? And I will tell you why I ask this question. And, you know, I just heard him saying that Pakistani journals drink whiskey at the end of the day. I have two serving journals who are my relatives. One has a long beard. He prays 4 or 5 times. The second one just went on a pilgrimage with his family So what we need to do, what we need to tell American people is that Pakistanis lost 100K in this war, and that we lost in Afghanistan, and the best thing for us to do at this point in time is, which we are doing, is to use ISI and Pakistan as a scapegoat.
Moline, I thank you for the call. Let's go right to your questions here. Steve Call, ISI agents you've met and time you've spent there, Mujahideen you've interviewed, he wants...
Yeah, I was based in the region as a correspondent for the Washington Post for 3 years, and Pakistan was part of my territory. I love Pakistan. I've traveled there continuously since 1989 when I first went out there. It's a very interesting and dynamic country. And I've certainly spent a lot of time with military officers and as many ISI officers as I can meet.
But it's also, as we learned from Daniel Pearl, a very dangerous place for
journalists. Well, it became dangerous. A lot of the time that I was out there in the early part of my career, it was actually a very easy place to work and not especially risky. I was able to travel a lot of the country. But after 2001, it became more and more dangerous, and the amount of space that international journalists can travel in has shrunk, and the risks you have to manage have grown. But it's still a good place to travel and work as a journalist. I think the caller said that his relatives have become more religious or are religious, and that, this image of the more secular tradition at the top of the Pakistan Army has been overtaken by more Islamicization or more integration of religious faith with professional duty in the Army. I think that's probably true. I think I've seen that shift over the years in lots of parts of Pakistan. But it's still, the Army is still a very professional organization, and they work very hard to manage the problem of radicalization inside their own ranks. And though there have been some cases of mutiny within the Army on radical Islamist grounds, they haven't yet split the Army or created a significant coup d'etat or something like that.
Moline, I thank you for the call. Let me go right to another caller, and that's Fred. Fred, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Yes, thank you, Michael. I just have a short comment that if Afghanistan had India as a neighbor to the east, they would have not had this much problem security-wise. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, well, the relationship between India and Afghanistan is part of what aggravates Pakistan, right? Because for Pakistan, it's all about India, and it fears that India wants to destroy Pakistan, and it sees Indian involvement in Afghanistan as a threat, and that's part of why they have tolerated the Taliban as a response, even promoted the Taliban as a response. And I think the Pakistani military leadership overestimates India's involvement in Afghanistan, but they're right that India does sometimes conspire with violent groups in order to give back to Pakistan what India thinks Pakistan does to India. So it is a proxy contest along that Afghan-Pakistan border, and it's getting nastier these days, I think.
Again, our guest is Steve Call, and his new book is Directorate S, the CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Sanjeev asks, what is your sense of whether the current administration has heeded the lessons of the past that you have articulated so well, or are we still blundering around that neighborhood because it's just too late?
You know, there's this thing in Washington, and it was sort of disheartening in the book to uncover it, unpack it so much in the case of the Obama administration following the Bush administration. But there's maybe it's our polarized politics. Maybe it's just the way government works. But when the new people come in, they basically take the attitude that everything the other people did was wrong. And so with the Trump administration, they've come in and said, well, the problem with the Obama administration was that they weren't clear enough that we're never going to leave, and they weren't tough enough on Pakistan. So after they went through their review, they reached the conclusion that they should withdraw aid from Pakistan, which I understand, and that they should signal to Pakistan, we're going to be here, we're going to fight to the last terrorist, you can't wait us out. Well, as I've said, the use of economic sanctions to change Pakistan's conduct doesn't have a great record, certainly not without some negotiation alongside it. And then this signaling about we're here forever, I'm not sure that it's very persuasive for the Pakistanis, because you know, they know we're a democracy. Our domestic politics are not going to last forever in support of this war.
They can be very patient.
They can be very patient. And plus, we were there with 150,000 troops just, you know, 7 years ago, and now we're down to 10 or 15,000. So it's not the kind of pressure that I think is likely to change Pakistan's basic sense of where its interests lie in the region.
Where do you think American notions are coming from mainly? Some say Mattis defense, some say Tillerson, and some say Trump. It's hard to sort out, isn't it?
Yeah, it'll be interesting to unpack exactly what was argued about during the Trump administration's review of the Afghan war. But it does seem that, you know, there were a few voices like Steve Bannon who were making the kind of America First radical argument that we should just pack up and go home. But that argument really didn't get very far. And that ultimately it was Mattis and the National Security Advisor, H.R. McMaster, both of whom have long experience in the war, who persuaded the president, you know, he could stay the course, make a few adjustments.
Well, you've had long experience, too. It served you well. Congratulations on your book. It's called Directorate S, the CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And Steve Cole will be at the Commonwealth Club here in San Francisco tonight at 6:30. Remind you, he's a staff writer for The New Yorker and dean of the Columbia Journalism School. So good to have you with us. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you, our listeners. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Tomorrow during this hour, we'll be talking to Daniel Pink about timing. He has a book out that goes to the scientific nature of what good timing is and what bad timing is. And continue to listen to this public radio station. It's KQED in San Francisco. And for all of us right here, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.